One of Joe's favorite pictures on that page was of the woman with the cleavage showing.
I did not say that.
In a world where only the strong survive, there comes a time when the only way to settle the score is a one-on-one battle to the finish. Two entrepreneurs enter, but only one of them leaves. It's the Entrepreneur Showdown with Joe Cassandra and Dan Franks. Now, on to the showdown.
This is the Entrepreneur Showdown. I am Dan Franks, coming on shortly, my partner in crime, Joe Cassandra. And yes, you may have noticed, it's a special Thursday edition of the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast, and that's because we're super excited to bring you the newest addition to the Entrepreneur Showdown family, and we're calling it Entrepreneur Showdown Presents, where every month we'll pick a theme of the month, and then every Thursday of that month we'll be interviewing an entrepreneur that fits in that theme. It's super exciting. We're super excited to bring you this new concept, and that starts Thursdays in October. Tune in next week, and we'll give you even more information on what's coming up. But don't despair, because every Monday, you'll still be getting three rounds of hard-hitting action from the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast that you've come to know and love. And speaking of three rounds of hard-hitting action, let's get this episode's three rounds started. Because in round one, Joe and I are going to talk about how our approach to dinner can enhance our productivity. This is kind of a weird concept, but I think you're going to like it. Then, in round two, Joe and I are going to discuss the visual aspects of your marketing, the visual aspects of your website, how you might be leaving money on the table by missing some very key components. You won't want to miss that. And then we're going to bring on somebody in the main event who's an expert in this visualization concept, and that's Neil Patel from Kissmetrics. Neil is a freaking rock star in the entrepreneur online game, and we're bringing him on in the main event, and we're super excited. So let's not waste any more time. For the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more, head on over to EntrepreneurShowdown.com. And now, let's get on with the showdown.
Round one.
It's round one, and Joe, you ready for dinner?
I'm always ready to eat.
I know you are, and you actually, your eating habits inspired me to decide that we should do this segment for round one. And the whole idea in this segment is how our approach to dinner can enhance our productivity. And it's kind of analyzing how we approach dinner, how the order we eat our food in, the style we eat our food, and maybe how that translates to how we operate daily in our business. And it goes back to an article by Andrew Rondo from WeBuildYourBlog.com. And he brings up this idea of a friend of his that does the salad and steak method is what he calls it. So the whole idea is his friend eats all the healthy food first, piece by piece. So first he eats his salad, then he eats all his vegetables, then all his carbs or pasta or whatever, and then he gets to whatever the unhealthy main course is. And he says if you translate this to your daily business, it would equate to first thing in the morning when you're freshest, when you have the most energy. That's when you address all the things that maybe you're not going to have a whole lot of energy or enthusiasm for working towards later in the day. And Joe, I have to pick on you because you do the exact opposite. The first time we ever got together to brainstorm about this podcast, we got some meal at some place that came with a cookie. And while you're waiting for the rest of your meal to show up, I have my cookie all wrapped up and waiting for me to finish the rest of my meal. Meanwhile, you're chowing down on your cookie, and I just looked at you and I said, what are you doing? You're eating your cookie before your meal? And you said, yeah, why not? So Joe, does that mean that you're super unproductive in your business duties?
I can be very unproductive at times, but I think in that circumstance, it's because I was really hungry and we only got the dessert first, so I ate the dessert.
I'm going to call you out. We went somewhere else a few weeks later, and you got a milkshake
and
that milkshake was gone before your meal came.
Because I got it first before my meal. Here's how I eat, and I got it from my grandfather, because this is how he eats. I just like go in a circle. I take one bite of one thing, one bite of another, and then just keep going in a circle. That's how I eat.
Well, I'm similar, but I don't go in quite the circle. I just kind of pick around like like some kind of ferret or something. I don't know what I eat like. But so tell me, how then let's translate this and let's move this over to something that's more applicable for the podcast. And that's, does this at all relate to how you work? Like if you were to equate your circular eating method to working, that would mean you do a steady rotation of first I'm going to work on something I don't really care about. Then I'm going to transition to something that I'm pretty enthusiastic about, and then kind of go back and forth there as opposed to going all one way or all the other.
Now that we think about this and we're talking about it, that's exactly how I work. I work, and this is any type of work, I do, I kind of go in a circle because I'm someone that can get bored easily. So I'll do one thing for a little bit and then go to the next thing and go to the next thing and go to the next thing and then just keep going in a circle until all of it's done. Unless it's like a time constraint thing, then of course I work on one thing. But if it's something that's just, I guess, like just normal, I will do that kind of. And I'll have to catch myself sometimes because I'll be like, no, you got to focus on this one thing. You're not going to be productive if you just keep scatterbrained. Because if you do that, what I do sometimes, you're trying to think of one problem, but then your mind's thinking about the other problem you have to work on. And then you really, and I can speak from experience, you don't get anything, you don't get done as much, and you don't look at the details as much. And I've gotten trouble with this like my whole life with my work ethic is because I don't look at the details as much as just like the general picture. The general picture, I'll be like, okay, yes, you're done, you're done, you're done. But the details will be a little, I don't know, messed up in a way. So
yeah, and I kind of suffer from this ADD type thing, I guess you could call it, because I really do sometimes feel like I have a lack of focus. But I have to say, I'm very envious of Andrew's friend in this article who's able to pick the hard things to work on first and then slowly work his way towards the things he's more enthusiastic about, because that acts almost, and I did not intend to use a food reference here, but it acts like the carrot that, you know, leading the horse. having something you're looking forward to on the back half of everything you're not looking forward to. Now, my work is more like your eating habits when I noticed you eating the cookie before the rest of your meal. When I open up my email box at the beginning of the day, I kind of glance through everything and skim through all the subjects, and I pick out the ones that look really easy or really entertaining, and those are the first things I tackle. And sometimes what happens when you do that is you get to the end of the week, you know, if that's a Monday, you get to the end of the week and those hard ones you still never touch, because every time you log in, you're going to address all the ones that look entertaining or exciting or easy, and you just leave those hard ones hanging. And then you come to this big culmination on Friday afternoon where you've got all this crap that you've been putting off all week. And then that's your Friday, is working through all that crap, and it makes for an awful day. And you're probably not, because you're in such a bad mood doing all these things at once, you're probably not going to address these negative issues as effectively as you would.
Well, then let's think about what should we do differently. Say for like your email example, should you just start at the very, whatever email came in first and just work from there? Or do you think it's more productive? And I think it's more productive to do the smallest and easiest things first, so you can get those out of the way and you're not thinking about them anymore. So you can spend, and this is how I think too, if I have to spend a lot of time on a big problem, then the whole time I'm working on that, I'm also thinking about, oh, I got all these little things too that I'm going to have to do right afterwards. While instead what I do is do all the little things first, and then I can just focus on the big thing. And I know right after I do this big problem, I'm done and I'm stress-free after that. Is that how you kind of do it?
No, I didn't. Like I said, I have my Gmail pulled up right now, and whenever I see something that's hard or that I don't want to deal with, I put my little star on it. And whenever it's something I do want to deal with, I just take care of it right there. So like I said, you get a few days down the road and all those easy little short things I've done, but you describe it more like a snowball effect. So you start little and it builds up and you build towards the bigger things. But I have enough little things to always keep me occupied that I just never get to those bigger things, and they just, I don't know, fester there until they start stinking really bad and I have to get to them before they, you know, turn rancid. I don't know.
Well, is that a big enough problem that you realize I'm being unproductive, or is it just kind of like an annoying type thing?
It's annoying, and I think it's a little unproductive. Now, if it's a customer coming to me or a client coming to me and it's a dire emergency or something, obviously I don't put that off. But it's just these little things that I probably should get to at some point soon, but because they're not 100% need to get done now and they're not something that I'm just super excited about, I just let them kind of build up. So I think that's something that I can work on. And I think probably there's a lot of people listening that can relate to that, because especially in the entrepreneurial space, there's so many little things that can pull you away that oftentimes seem more exciting, whether it's, hey, I need to post a new Facebook ad. That sounds more interesting than responding to this horrible customer complaint that has, you know, needs all this technical support. So I can absolutely see how this can affect people at various you know, stages in their career.
Yeah, that's interesting. Everyone has their own way of doing something. If you can find the productive way to do it, I get annoyed when people try and put their productivity habits on you. That's what gets me ticked off, because I work a certain way, and you try, some people try and change it because, oh, my way is better. But I mean, maybe that's not how I want to work. Maybe I will be 30 minutes slower than you completing your work, but I like to do it that way because maybe it's less stress on me that way.
Yeah, and I absolutely have experienced that, people trying to push their own habits on you. And I think maybe that's the takeaway from this, is that everybody eats their food differently, right? And there's no right or wrong way to eat your food. And same thing, there's no right or wrong way to do your work or get through your daily tasks. It's as long as whatever your method is gets things done, like you said, if it takes 30 minutes, but you're willing to put that extra 30 minutes in, then who really cares as long as you get to the same point at the end? So I think that this food discussion has turned into something pretty valuable about just managing your day-to-day work and prioritizing tasks and how to be the most productive. And you know what, Joe? If you want to eat your cookie first, you go ahead and eat that cookie. And now, on to round two.
Round two.
In round two today, we're going to be talking about a series of blog posts on QuickSprout by Neil Patel. Now, Neil's known very widespread for quite a bit of different things, but namely, he's known as the one guy in this online space that works with all these large companies, Amazon, NBC, GM, HP, Viacom, all these large Fortune 500 companies or even larger companies come to him and his team to work on their websites or to figure out what's wrong with their marketing online and how to improve it. And three of these most recent blog posts that he's put up have all been about the general topic of visualization. They covered various spectrums of the visualization topic when it comes to websites and content marketing and all of this. And I find it interesting that Neil focuses on this, and I think it's something that a lot of people don't really think about. Now, they want their website to look pretty, of course, or they want a pretty logo or graphic at the top of their website. But a lot of what Neil talks about is, just because something looks pretty to you as the creator, that's not necessarily what the consumer is looking for. And one of these articles is about eye tracking. And he goes over some very specific details about how you can turn your advertisements or your maybe banner ads or your top graphic on your front page, how you can turn that in just from a pretty picture into something that actually directs your readers where you want to go. So, for instance, if you have a person's picture, a face in your graphic, one of the things he says is, if this guy's looking right at you, then you're going to look right at him and you're not going anywhere else on the page. Whereas a very big thing is, if their eyes are pointed somewhere, then you're going to follow those eyes to wherever they're looking. So if you have a graphic, for instance, at the top with a woman's face, if she's looking right at you, you're not going to look at anything else on the page. For the most part, the majority of people will look her right in the eyes and then navigate off the page, which is really interesting. But he has scientific studies to back this up. Whereas if she's maybe looking at the sidebar where all your banner ads, your eyes are going to follow hers to this sidebar. I think this is like something that nobody thinks about really. But when it seems so obvious, and that's kind of what's great about all Neil's content, is when you read it, you're like, well, of course, that makes perfect sense. It's something that you can easily consume and easily understand, but it's things that you don't think about until he points it out to you.
It's not like these big, like huge tactical things. It's like these very subtle things, like you just mentioned, with the eyes looking right at you or just looking somewhere else. Like, it automatically just changes the whole perception of it. And then we look at other articles too, that how people love media and pictures, and people are more visual and they like those type of things. That's why Pinterest is getting so big, because it's just all visual stuff. And like one of the big things for people who try and rank in Google, if you can get like your picture next to like your article, it's been shown and proven that people will click on that article, even if it's like third down the page, they'll click on that article because it has a picture on it, because it's more trustworthy than even if you're at the very top and you have no picture. So we're very visual humans, and I guess he's like finding ways that, hey, here's how you can use pictures, and it doesn't have to be just like some pretty chick like he has also in the post, but you can do other little things to use media to your advantage for conversion purposes.
Yeah, and he also talks about going to that beautiful woman that he has.
And I, you'll have to check out the blog post for the reason that Joe and I are calling her this beautiful woman. But one of the things he talks about is how men and women interpret things differently, too. So when you put out an ad, you really have to think about who you're trying to target. Are you trying to target men, women, or both? And one of the things he talked about in this picture, this woman showing quite a bit of cleavage. And they did a sex test, what men look at first and what women look at first.
And guess what men looked at.
And guess what women, yeah, guess what men look at first. Men look directly at the chest and pretty much nowhere else. Whereas, oh, by the way, Joe, I know you didn't notice this, but she's got a beautiful wedding ring on as well. And that's where women's eyes immediately go to. So it's interesting that, you know, if this ad was maybe in Cosmo magazine or something like that, Joe's probably the only guy reading that magazine. So so if this is a advertisement for a wedding ring, you could put this very same picture in Cosmo and it would go directly, you know, it would be a good advertisement for a wedding ring. Whereas if it's in a men's magazine, nobody's going to even notice she's wearing this ring. So that's a little thing that you don't necessarily think about when you pick out a stock image for your blog, or if you're on a big scale and you have a photo shoot of models. These are things that you might not necessarily think about, but the specific image that you pick could be greatly affecting the productivity or the effectiveness of that. And he goes on, you'll have to check out the articles for yourself, and we'll link them up in the show notes. But he goes on to talk about some different strategies for pictures to use on your page, photographs of people, and how to really bring the focus to whatever part of this ad or whatever part of this website you're really trying to drive people to.
Yeah, and for that sex test as well, he mentions Timothy Sykes, and I know I've listened to some of Timothy's interviews with like Andrew Warner and others, and Neil mentions that 98% of Timothy's audience are men, and if you look at Tim's site or his Facebook page, a lot of what he puts is like big, nice cars with women in bikinis and stuff like that, and he's taken full advantage of something like that where he knows what men are looking at and what they're going for. No matter how much a man denies it, it's just they're looking at that stuff. So,
hey, speak for yourself, Joe. I mean, that's a beautiful wedding ring that she's wearing.
Exactly. My wife would love that, and I love it too.
So let me ask you, this idea you're talking about with the fast cars and the beautiful women and really appealing to men, this kind of is a little off topic, but someone like MJ DeMarco with this Fastlane Millionaire, obviously his big graphic is a car, right?
Yeah.
So is that his, or I guess not a car, but a highway? It implies that, you know, this it applies a car is driving down this highway. Is that some is that visualization purposely trying to draw men in? Do you think something like that?
I'm gonna say that his audience is a lot of men. If you go on the Fastlane forum and you've read through it, a lot of them sound like men. So I'm pretty sure that's part of the marketing ploy. I know when he first had, and this, we're going way off topic here, but when he first put out his first cover, it was just like a Lamborghini or something with, I think, like a model on it. And a lot of people said, hey, this actually looks kind of scammy. Not as much, hey, this is attracting men. I'm sure a lot of men looked at the cover, but a lot of them also thought it was scammy because people get pulled that way that, hey, if you're advertising that you can get cars and free women, then it's automatically a scam. And Timothy kind of does the opposite. He puts all that out there and says, hey, you can have this. And he's like, if you think it's a scam, then screw you. Cause that's just how he is. He's an F you type of person. He's fine with that. So, I guess it depends on what kind of vibe you want to give off. If you feel like it may have some scam behind it, you may want to test it first. Or if you just have that F you attitude, you just go and do it anyway.
Yeah, I think that's interesting with that MJ DeMarco example, because that proves, based on his changing of the cover once he got that feedback, that proves that you can go too far with this. Like, so if you think, hey, I'm going to appeal to men, so I'm going to put all these things on the cover at once that men love, maybe kind of there's an overload factor there that you have to be careful of. And in the third of this trifecta of blog posts from Neil Patel that we're covering, he calls it 7 simple copywriting tricks that'll shoot up your conversion rate. And to me, this is less about copywriting and more about how you use the copywriting, because he gives a few examples. And again, we'll link to this so you can look at all the examples. But he gives a few examples of split tests that websites and companies have run, where they'll do one website that's mainly word-based, even though it's a great-looking website, it's got a whole lot more words, whereas the other side of the split test would be mainly focused on a person or a large graphic, and then the words are kind of secondary. But even though those words are secondary, maybe the opt-in box or the sign-up form is much smaller, because it's a much more simpler website. The conversion rates have doubled or tripled even. And it's very interesting to think that when you're creating this website, you're so worried about exactly what all these words are going to say and where they're going to go. When Neil's studies show the truth is less words, the better. So maybe all these words you're focusing on are really hurting you, not helping you.
I guess he's saying that, hey, definitely focus on the copywriting, but make it as simple and brief as possible. And one of the points he makes is to highlight the benefits rather than the solution, which I've heard different things. I've heard you should show them the solution, and that's what's going to sell them. So that'll be an interesting thing to ask him about. But just something like a real simple graph he has is he's showing Square's page, and it just says someone swiping a credit card and very few words on the page, and it just says start accepting credit cards today. And I guess that's kind of a benefit and a solution, so it's kind of hitting both of them. But when people try and think of copy, they always try and think, okay, I got to use these eloquent words or try and think of something fancy like what Mad Men used to do when they wrote ads. But here it's just something really simple. Just start accepting credit cards today. Hey, it gets the point across, and it also shows what problem they're solving as well. So if you're able to find that very simple answer in 5 words or less, I mean, I think you got something there, which I always have trouble with. I'm not a good copywriter, so I'm always looking for tweaks to better my copywriting prowess, I guess.
Well, I think this is interesting, and it's maybe something that people out there that are working on affiliate pages or some kind of niche pages could actually benefit from. Because, look, the old way of doing these things is these long-form sales pages where you have a catchphrase or at the top. You have a big headline. You have a picture. You have a description of the products. You have reviews. You have testimonials. You have calls to action. You have videos. And that's the whole idea behind these long-form sales pages is cram all this information to these people at once so that you're convincing them to take action on whatever you're trying to sell or trying to market, push to them. Whereas Neil's showing you, you know, with proof on large companies and small companies alike, that simpler is better. So that might come as a relief to some people that are working on putting up these websites. Hey, you might have to put more thought and effort into what the words say, but the words are fewer, the words are less. And to me, that means it's, in the long term, easier to create these websites and easier to create something appealing now that you know you don't have to put all this content in one place.
And we'll get right to Neil, but just a quick point. I know that, and this will be something we can talk to him about as well, but like someone like Ramit Sethi, if you've ever seen one of his, I guess, like product pages when he sends them out to his list, they're a good, 10 pages long. And he swears by it that, hey, I get great conversions out of it. And he makes a lot of money. We all know that. While Neil here is saying, and hopefully we'll get Ramit on at some point, but Neil here is saying, screw all that long copy. Just make it one little blurb. Or he also mentions that if you have like multiple layers of pages with a bunch of good copy on it, that works as well. But if you just have something like that, that it's going to convert more. So, I mean, I don't know if he knows Ramit at all, but we can ask him about that and what he thinks about it, and I'm sure we'll get into a good discussion about that.
Yeah, and there's certainly lots of experts and lots of people that are doing things that work, so it's interesting to get different people's point of view. But on that, we definitely want to get on right to Neil in the main event.
It's time for the main event.
In the main event today, Joe and I welcome a true rock star in the online marketing world, Neil Patel. Neil's been a serial entrepreneur from a very young age and is best known as founder of the successful website visitor analysis tools at Crazy Egg and the even more successful Kissmetrics web analytics solution. Neil blogs at quicksprout.com, and if you've ever checked out any of his content, you'd agree that it's some of the highest quality content on the net. In round two, Joe and I discussed 3 of Neil's most recent blog posts that all had to do with eye tracking, visualization, and how to leverage that knowledge on your own ads and websites. And that's what we wanted to bring Neil on to talk about today. So without further ado, Neil, thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. We really appreciate your time. Now, you have a fascinating story, and we want to dig into some of it in a bit. But first, let anyone know who's not familiar with you and your background what the best place to go is to find out more about you.
Sure, it's my about page on quicksprout.com, so quicksprout, and just click on the about link in the navigation and you'll learn all about me.
Yeah, and it's a very detailed about page. It's very
highly appreciated from those of us who read your content to be able to see that versus some people that have a few words and you still don't feel like you know the person. So yeah, we'll definitely link that up in the show notes. Now this whole visualization concept that Joe and I just got done discussing with each other is something you specialize in, and some of your tools that have made you your millions focus on just that. But can you kind of let everyone know what first led you to focusing on visualization and eye tracking and kind of that whole thing, and what led you to focusing on that as such a key piece to the puzzle?
Yeah, so I used to run a consulting company with my co-founder years ago, and him and I also co-founded the visualization companies with the two analytics companies. And what we ended up learning was people would actually see an increase in traffic, whether it's the Google Analytics, Omniture, or whatever it may be, and they're like, cool, why aren't we seeing any more revenue, right? And they couldn't answer those questions because they didn't understand how those visitors actually engage with their site. So the first product, Crazy Egg, was to help solve that. We're like, all right, let's see actually how people are engaging with your site and figure out how to make your design and the elements on your webpage more usable and optimized for conversions. Because if you can do that, more of those visitors will convert into customers, right? And then from there, we actually evolved that product and spun off a little piece of it, and it created into a much larger company this day, and it's called Kissmetrics. And that starts focusing on, hey, right, there's all these page views and vanity metrics and things that don't necessarily affect your bottom line, unless you're, let's say, like a publishing-based company that's ad-driven. But let's say if you're an e-commerce company, you're getting visitors, you don't care how many visitors you get. You care about how many sales you get, right? 1 million visitors or 100,000 visitors don't make a difference. But what does make a difference is $100,000 or $1 million, right? So if you're making $1 million versus $100,000, that's a huge difference. And we saw that there's not always a direct correlation between visitor count and revenue. So I was talking to an e-commerce site during Christmas holidays, right? I know that was a while back. And the guy's just like, yeah, you know, things are going well right now during the holiday season. I'm like, oh, wow. I'm like, you know, how's the business? He's like, traffic's almost doubled. I'm like, wow. I'm like, what happened to revenue? He's like, oh, it's roughly flat. And I'm like, that sucks, right? So it's like, why are you saying business is doing well when it's flat? If you're telling me holiday is a peak time, he's like, well, it's a peak time for traffic. Traffic doesn't really matter then, right? If you're getting 10 times the amount of traffic and it's not converting, it doesn't matter. If the traffic converts, then, of course, you know, it's a different story, but we started building Kissmetrics to help businesses focus on the bottom line, like revenue, churn, conversion rates, all those kind of metrics.
Okay, so say you get hired on, the Kissmetrics gets brought on a new client, say it's a big client, and they have that exact problem that you just described. They're getting tons of traffic, but the conversions just don't match up. What's the first thing you do when you look at this website? Where's the first place you look to see what you can change to improve it?
So you don't necessarily go out there and be like, all right, how can you improve the conversion rates and by just changing elements? Instead, you do a server-based or objection-based. So you can use Qualaroo, SurveyMonkey, whatever tool you want. You ask specific questions, such as, what is the number one reason you aren't buying the product? Or what else would you like to see on this page, right? I'm just making up hypothetical questions. You're getting these questions and you're looking for patterns. So when you start getting 100, 200, 300 responses, you'll get people saying, I'm afraid of putting in my credit card on this page. I'm not sure what I get for the money. I don't know how much this is going to cost me. So then you start fixing these things within your copy. You then take the original version, you take the new version, you do an A-B test. If the new version converts higher based off the feedback you got, right, so you're making the changes based off the feedback, you now have a higher converting version. If not, you go back to those same people, survey them, get them understand why it didn't convert better, what changes did you make that didn't work out in your favor, and then go from there. In an ideal world, you should only try to change one element at a time. If your conversion rates really suck, then you can just go for the whole page. But drastic changes could lead to big results. But then again, when you make too many changes at once, you may not know what's causing conversions to go up or down. So it's a double-edged sword.
Okay, and I definitely want to get to the split testing that you touched on in a minute. But let's go even further back. So you said that where you would start is to find out what the objections are and ask the questions to find out what the objections are. But let's say, how do you determine what the questions need to be? Can they just be very generic questions, or is there some way to figure out what these questions need to be to even ask to find what the objections are?
The easiest thing to do, there's a guy named Sean Ellis. He's the owner of Qualaroo. and he's really good with conversions, and he released the whole product market fit philosophy, right? And pretty much it's a survey to figure out if your customers love your product, and if it does, then you actually got a good product. And he figured out how to get that data in a non-biased way. So at the same time, he came up with questions that you could ask people that'll help you improve your conversions. So Qualaroo has predefined questions. You can sign up, it's dirt cheap, or there may even be a free trial, and you can pick from one of their predefined questions that should help you.
Well, if we go back to, I guess, the pictures and everything that you were looking at with visualization, like one of them, you have a girl looking at you and not looking at the shampoo, and then another one where she's looking at the shampoo, and you say that she looks at the shampoo, it converts more. When you're doing these tests, like, how the hell do you know, oh, if I just change her eyes to look towards the shampoo, just that one little change, do you have to do all these like very little changes like all the time?
You should, but the way I see it is it's all about data. So with me, I'm going out there and I'm Googling and seeing what other tests people have ran that are successful. I'm also looking at what tests have they run that's not successful. I'm trying to network and talk with other people who are running A-B tests on their sites and finding out what's working and what's not working. So I'm taking this big collective group of data, analyzing and seeing if anything could be a good fit for our products and services that I may own, and then making changes from there. So it's just data, right? And I found out from people saying that, hey, if the person and looks at the call to action or points at it, you're going to more likely get more clicks and sales. So I tested it out because one of my buddies, Ryan Dice, told me to test that out. And it worked, and he was right. And then other people also tested that, and they were right. And I was Googling, and I found a ton of other data that backed up his claims.
So if for someone who's, I guess, trying to figure out like what kind of image they should use just for their website, are there certain steps that you guys take that say, okay, this image needs this to make it, I guess, a highly converting picture? Or are you just taking thousands of pictures and trying each one of them?
Neither. I don't even test out the images because it's too early on. You first maximize the page by asking objections, like people saying, oh, I don't want to buy unless there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. You fix all of those issues first. Then you go to the small things like the images. All right, let me test the image, or let me test the image on the video, right? Because you know how all videos have like a still image before you click the play button, like on YouTube. So you just start testing each of them out and you figure out what works best for you or what doesn't work for you. But the trick first is to optimize the known elements, the ones that answer objections, because those will boost the conversions the most. All these other things shouldn't have as major of an impact. If they are having a big impact, that means there's other elements on the page that are causing a decrease in conversion that you should be focusing on first.
Now I want to talk about one of these blog posts that specifically talked about eye tracking, and I think the picture that Joe was talking about was part of that blog post, and kind of looking at these pictures or these advertisements or parts of a website and studying where the eyes are looking first and then where the sight line is flowing to on the page. And one of the, I don't know why, one of Joe's favorite pictures on that page was of the woman with the cleavage showing.
I did not say that.
No, I keep throwing Joe under the bus here because I get control of the bus at this point. And the whole point of this picture was the one with the cleavage. It showed the men looked at the cleavage more than anything else, and the women looked at the wedding ring the woman was wearing. And the whole point of this was to know your target market, and then after you pick your target market or you focus in on your target market, then you pick out that image or use that image. What if in a situation like that, what if your target market is men and women, for instance?
You start with neutral images, neutral colors. So there's an infographic by Kissmetrics that talks about the meaning of colors. If you Google it, you'll find it. And you figure out neutral colors that both men and women like, and you start selecting those images first, if your audience is both. Right. And then you want them to look at the call to actions, the product, the phone number, the lead forms, whatever it may be. But that's what you would do if your audience is targeted to both men and women. If it's targeted towards men, then you could use whatever images you think would have the most appeal. And it's funny, like looking at that image, which they're showing the cleavage, that would actually be a terrible image in most cases from what I've tested to show on a site that's targeted to men. Why? Because they're paying attention to that area of the woman versus the call to action buttons.
Well, like say for that picture, I guess, would you take this picture and then try and think of what product do I have right now that that picture would be good for? Is that how, like, how your thought process should work?
It's the opposite. I'd look at the product. I'm like, what images would be good for this product? So I ideally want to try to find, I want the photo to represent a potential buyer, right? I want them to look, if my buyer looks like a supermodel, I want my photo to look like a supermodel. If my buyer looks like an average computer geek who's sitting behind a chair, I want my photo to look like an average computer geek sitting behind the chair. Because what we found is people relate to images that are similar to them. When they're not similar, they're like, oh, that's unrealistic. I can never be that person. I can never look like that. So it never converts.
Well, I know you mentioned Timothy Sykes in that post right after the cleavage woman. And I know for him, he does that. He, because I guess, like you said, 98% of his customers are men, that he puts like these big Lamborghinis and he puts these bikini clad women and all that. Have you talked to him to see if that's really converting or that's just his kind of brash style?
So it's also his lifestyle and he enjoys it, but it is converting because he's not, if you look, he's not putting, he's not focusing on his website, like on his sales pages or his bias pages. He's mainly using them, now don't get me wrong, he uses them in blog posts every once in a while, but he's using them on Facebook to attract new people because he's trying to pitch, like, you could have this lifestyle too, and it works well for him.
I want to ask, go back to the part where you said you don't, if you have a website that's targeting the geeks, you don't want to make it look like a supermodel on the page, but what if it's a kind of product where it's, you know, it's a body transformation or some kind of beauty product. You don't want to put somebody, I don't want to say as fat as them, on there, but you want to put like kind of an aspiration image on there, right? Would that be a little different situation or would you still go for the...
I would still go for the normal looking person. I would do a before or after, and I would make sure the after isn't photoshopped and stuff like that, because too many afters, after, like, you know, they lost weight, they photoshopped the face, while the before image, they wouldn't. I would keep them non-photoshopped. I would just do straight up before and after. Those tend to convert better in spaces like that because there's too much phony baloney images going around and people know it.
Okay, well then let me talk about something that's a huge offender of this this rule we just put in place as far as being real and being believable with your advertisement, and that's these long form spammy sales pages that you actually saw a lot more a few years ago but then you do now, and you even mentioned this in one of your blog posts how these long form sales pages just aren't converting like simple to the point pages. Is this a case of these long form sales pages used to work better than they do now, or are we just getting smarter as far as what's working and what's not?
So they still do work, but there's many cases where they don't work. It's all based on the audience. What people have found out over the years is shorter form pages with video instead of the long form, so video, a text in that video, they're just pretty much taking those messages in that long page and putting it in video format and making it simpler. That's converting extremely well these days.
What about for, I don't know if you've ever seen Ramit Sethi's landing pages, and they're like 500 pages long with testimonies, copy, everything like that, and he says it converts a lot. Would you ever say to him, hey, you're doing it wrong that way?
So I know Ramit quite well. Ramit's tested out video as well. Video converts better for him than the long text, but he does both.
So what? Why do you think that that works for him while you say most of the time the short pictures and the short copy would actually...
It depends what you're selling. Ramit's products are expensive. If you're selling a product in the thousands of dollar price point, you can't do a short page. If you're selling a $5 product, you don't need a ton of copy. If you're selling a $1,000 product or $200-$300 product, people need to get to know you. They need to feel comfortable before they buy. That's why those long pages work really well in Ramit's cases. It's hard to sell a multi-$1,000 product with just say, hey, check this out, buy it, right? You're probably not going to buy it. You want to understand what you're getting. You're not going to make a $1,000 decision without really understanding what you're going to get.
What about I guess we're veering away from the pictures, but what about testimonials? Have you tested that and seen how much it, just having one testimonial is a big converter compared to not having one?
I found that testimonials do help, but the testimonials have to be realistic. I tested out testimonials on my traffic system, and people felt they were unrealistic. Like, they were real testimonials, but they felt the results were so unachievable that the conversions tanked at one point as well. So you got to pick the right testimonials as well.
So Neil, I want to talk about go back to something you talked about earlier, and I said we'd get back into it, and that's A-B split testing. It's very popular. It's very effective. It's been proven effective in all sorts of uses online. But what would you look at and say, maybe this kind of situation isn't the right place for A-B split testing, so that our listeners, if they're thinking about it, might not waste their time if they're using it in the wrong way?
Yeah, A-B split testing should be used by pretty much almost every business, right? And the way it works is, as long as you're testing two different variations against each other, it's worth a shot. You just have to be careful to not run too many split tests based off your gut, because if you run too many split tests based off your gut, you're going to find a lot of losing variations. You actually need to do it based off of objections, because keep in mind, when a split test is losing, that means you're losing money. When it's gaining, that means you're gaining money. So you got to make sure that you're basing it off of data and not your gut.
So what's your, I guess, sample size, or what's your metric for deciding when to make the final decision? Like, do you usually know right away one's converting way better than the other, or do you kind of give it some time, just, you know, maybe the time of the week or time of month affected it and you want to give it a little more time?
So let's say you're using Google Content Experiments, right, which is a free A-B testing tool. When you're doing A-B testing and you're using that tool, they will tell you when the results are statistically significant. When they're statistically significant, that means that, hey, like, there's a 99.5% chance that if you make this new variation, the default variation, you'll improve your conversion rate by, let's say, like 20%. That's when you know that you should make it stick with the new variation, because the program itself will pick a winner at the end. And it'll actually even tell you while the test is running, not enough data yet to conclude which page is the winner.
When you're doing this A-B split testing, and you just talked about, you know, the metrics you use to pick which, you know, A or B is working out better, and that's the one to focus on. But do you ever take that winner and then put that against a different, and then split test it again, and just keep changing what you're split testing against to try to see if, you know, what won in your first, you know, what prevailed in your first A-B split test was better, but maybe there's something else better out there that you could do, you know, and increase your conversions even more. At what point do you decide, yes, this is the one I'm sticking with versus I'm going to keep split testing?
No, you got it right. You should never stop. And after you have a winner, you should go try to find more tests to keep running. It's a never-ending game. Just like you always do SEO to your site, or you keep running paid advertising, or you keep tweaking your design to keep it up to date, or keep modifying your product, you always run A-B tests. It's a never-ending game, because you could always try to figure out new ways to boost your conversion.
So it's just, say, we'll use your site, for example. I'm guessing then you're split testing tons of things right now just while we're on your site?
I am. I try not to do more than one or two split tests at a time, but yeah, I am split testing right now.
What's your most common thing that, if you're going to implement one split test at the very beginning of a site that you're starting to work with, is it the opt-in form? Is that usually what it is, or do you have other things you go right to as well?
Yeah, for me, it's typically what I get the most objections off of. So if it's the headlines or the pricing or whatever it may be based off the survey data, that's what I get to in first.
I wanted to look at, you had your seven simple copywriting tweaks, and one of them you say is highlight the benefits more than the solutions. And we hear all the time for people who are trying to start a business, hey, look for solutions to problems, and that's all you hear, solutions, but you never hear the benefits, because like in like the lean startup, they say, hey, just launch your product and don't worry about the benefits right now. You can add those on later. How do you feel about that?
The way I end up seeing it is you should end up, and that could work if you're just trying to get a product out there, but when you're optimizing for conversions, and you don't do this when you're just trying to get a product out there, you're first trying to reach product market fit. You're optimizing for conversions once you start getting revenue, right? Mm-hmm. The way I end up seeing it is the purpose of the benefits is people right now typically know the solutions out there. They're trying to figure out which one's the right one for them. So instead of pitching, here's your problem and here's the solution, and I'm not saying you shouldn't pitch any solution part, you need to focus heavily on benefits as well. And that's the mistake people are making, because they're just talking about the solution and never the benefits. Well, a lot of times, and Harvard did a study on this, people know a lot of the solutions out there. They're trying to figure out of all the existing solutions, which one has the best benefits or the features or whatever it may be that relates to their needs.
When you say benefits, does that mean just try and add as much flash as you can onto your product?
Not necessarily Flash, because you should always try to create the most simplest product. But what I mean by benefits is like 30-day free trial, right? 60-second setup, ease of use. The free trial is low commitment. Another thing that you can end up doing is you talk about specific features that you know solve their pain point and make it really easy for them.
Do they need to be like extra unique, or say other people are doing the same thing?
That's fine if some other people are doing the same thing. The benefit could be that you're 5 times cheaper.
So you would say, hey, if someone is out there and they have a lot of competitors, just try and find one benefit that you could just break away. If it's cut your price by 10% or whatever, go and do that and then just hammer home that benefit. Is that what you're saying?
Or you would pick a few benefits and hammer them home, but yes.
Okay, I have a question from the same blog post, and this is the copywriting, the 7 tips for copywriting, and it's build your relationship before you sell, and this somewhat relates to something I used to do real estate investing, and the whole mantra was, well, if you're direct mailing these potential home sellers, you don't actually get the response until your 7th or 8th touch of these people. Is this something similar that you just keep mailing and you see the conversions increase down the road as opposed to upfront?
It is, and many times what ends up happening is when you build the relationships, you're not going to do well in the beginning, but later on down the road, you just keep getting more and more revenue from those relationships. It's much easier and the conversion rates are higher than it is to just go and sell. Sure, it's a longer term strategy, but it's a much more effective strategy.
Now, something I see with in that situation is some of these smaller companies that maybe they're a little cash strapped or they're trying to watch expenses. Sometimes they'll email you and say, hey, if you don't want to be on my list anymore, then click unsubscribe because I'm trying to save money. You know, I pay per the subscriber. So at what point is there ever a time when not necessarily it's a good idea to send out an email like that, but any time where you cut bait with people, you realize, okay, this person is not going to be converted. I need to just get rid of them and put my money and efforts towards other people? Is there ever a time for that?
There is, and through good emailing solutions like GetResponse and Infusionsoft, you can actually do stuff like, if they haven't opened up any of your emails in the last 6 months, remove them from the list.
I have a question about the, because you say, I'm going back to the heat map one, you said that you should use a lot of faces, and having faces, I guess it builds like a trust factor as well. Would you say that?
Yes, I definitely think it does help build a trust factor.
Have you ever seen or tested if you have a celebrity's face compared to just a normal person's face, or attractive versus ugly, those type of tests?
So I've typically found, not always, but in most cases, ugly beats out pretty. And I've found that celebrity beats out non-celebrity.
So ugly celebrities are where it's at.
Pretty much.
So I want to hop in and ask about like cartoon faces, and I know that might sound stupid, but right now it's super huge that you see like between with infographics or even just graphics on pages, you see cartoon faces. Have you done any studies on cartoons?
I found that cartoon faces don't convert as well as real faces. I've tried it twice and it just miserably.
2 times is enough. Well, what about on like infographics where cartoons are kind of the easiest way to go? Have you tried real faces on infographics versus cartoon faces?
Yeah, I've tried all that kind of stuff on infographics. And I haven't seen a huge difference whether you use a real person or not, but infographics is just about traffic, right? And getting the links. It's not necessarily about boosting conversions.
Okay, so infographics, one of the things you mentioned was that it converts, or that people read it, are more likely, 30 times more likely to read it, I think was the exact number, versus regular a text blog post. Why are infographics so much more popular to read than even like content rich blog posts? Because you see plenty of blog posts where there's filled with pictures and videos, but why are infographics better than even those?
So infographics are really popular compared to those because it makes the information more digestible. When you do really long text, yes, there's going to be people who read it and implement the advice, but a lot of times you have to be technical to implement all that kind of stuff, right? Infographics dumb everything down where it's applicable to almost anyone. Because if it's not, that means it's not a good infographic.
Gotcha. Well, Neil, we appreciate your time. What are you working on right now? We know QuickSprout, you're constantly updating it with rock solid content. And then, of course, KissMetrics is going off like crazy. Is there anything else new that you're working on?
That's mainly, yeah, I spend all my time on KissMetrics these days, and I blog at QuickSprout when I have some spare time.
Okay, is there anything new you're trying to do with QuickSprout? I know you said you're constantly trying new A/B testing. Is there anything new we'll see coming from QuickSprout, or just kind of the same solid content that we've come to know?
Same solid content, and in 30 days you'll probably see the launch of QuickSprout University.
Oh, sweet.
I already have 48 videos, educational videos that teach you specific marketing tactics like link building, on-page SEO, and stuff like that. And my goal is to get it to like 68, 70 videos, if not 80, before launch. But the videos, a lot of them are pretty much done. The part that I'm waiting on right now is designs wrapping up, and then in a few weeks I'll start the coding of it.
Well, very good. We appreciate that. Neil Patel, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate your time.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Neil.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love it if you join us every Monday morning to hear the latest episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast. Remember, the place to go to find the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more is www.entrepreneurshowdown.com. And while you're there, leave us your email address to find out about upcoming guests, latest episode releases, and a whole lot more.